it's a term that has a legendary beginning. There are many different stories of how it came about, but the most credible one is that it's supposedly derived from the name of a Canadian golfer, David Mulligan, a one-time manager of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City, who played at the Country Court Club of Montreal, and he was playing during the 1920s, and as the story goes, a day after hitting a poor tee, he was out there, he was on the green with some of his friends, he hit a poor tee shot. And Mulligan decided, well, he's going to re-tee, and he's going to shoot again, and just keep playing. And he called it a correction shot. You know, the course didn't go how I wanted, we need a correction shot. Well, his friends thought that it would be more fitting to name the practice after him. And so the term develops a mulligan, which started off in golf, and now we have it applied to all kinds of sports and everything else. A mulligan is just a second chance. You know, it's a second opportunity to perform an action that you've already done that was normally done in a terrible way, right? This is a blunder. This is a disaster. We need to start off with a clean slate. Let's try this again. It's a mulligan. Now, I've only played golf once in my life. But once was enough for me to understand what it's like to take a swing, hit the tee, see the ball shoot off, and wish that I course correct. Say, oh man, that is not going anywhere near the right direction. But I've lived long enough to have the experience on more than one occasion to get a little hot-headed, fly off at the tee and let a word or two go off, and wish, oh, you know, I wish I could take that word back, or that action back. And maybe you've experienced something like that. Maybe you've taken a wrong step or taken a wrong turn and wish you could go back and try it again. Do it right this time. Maybe you've said something that you know you shouldn't have said. You should have been quiet at that time. Or maybe you were quiet when something was said and you know that you should have stood up. Should have spoken up. You wish you could go back. Try it again. So the question I ask is, have you ever felt that? Have you ever wished you could go back, start off with a clean slate? That's the story of the Old Testament. From Adam to Nehemiah. One blunder after another. And people wishing that they could go back, knowing what they know now, and start over. And fix this mess. And the hope of the Old Testament is, while this story is progressing in one direction, there is one coming who will fix this mess. So the story is our looking for this one, this seed of the woman, this one from the tribe of Judah, this one from David that's going to come, this king who's going to fix the problem, who's going to crush the head of the serpent, who's going to restore the cursed creation, who's going to overcome death and going to bring us into a new period, a new kingdom. We're going back to the garden. Now Israel has made it back to the garden. Per se. They're back in the land. And they're expecting now, the clock is ticking since they came back to the land and since a decree has come out for the rebuilding of the walls, and they've seen the walls go up. They know the clock's ticking and they're expecting this one to come. But as they heard last week, we saw them get together and they asked Ezra to come and to read the law and to find out about their God and His ways and to find out just how bad they've blown it. We find them in our text today wanting a mulligan. They want a clean slate. They want to get it right this time because if they have the opportunity, they can do it. So after a 3-week long celebration where the sons of Israel were observing the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Booths, the festivities have finally come to an end. And their people are allowed to return to business as usual. And that's where we pick up in Nehemiah chapter 9, if you'll go ahead and turn there. They're finally allowed to return to business as usual after the fun, after the partying, after the eating and drinking and sharing and celebrating. 2 days have passed since the celebration ended, but the sons of Israel haven't returned to business as usual. They've regathered together once again, but they didn't come this time to eat. They didn't come to drink. They didn't come to be merry. Notice it. Chapter 9, verse 1. Now on the 24th day of this month, this is the 7th month, the sons of Israel assembled with fasting in sackcloth and with dirt upon them. And the descendants of Israel separated themselves from all the foreigners and stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. And while they stood in their place, they read from the book of the law of the Lord their God for a fourth of the day, and for another fourth they confessed and worshipped the Lord their God. So the people have assembled in the most uncomfortable and unattractive and unpopular way they can possibly assemble. And I ask, why? Well, as we just mentioned, in the previous chapter when they assembled, upon listening to the biblical story, this is the books of Moses, so the Pentateuch, that is the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, upon listening to the biblical story, they were grieved. So we're coming to find out who we are, our history, and our God. And the response was grief because they realized they're lawbreakers. They're lawbreakers, and they come from a long line of lawbreakers. They have a good pedigree of rebellion. And they saw the direction they were headed was the same direction that those before them had went. If they continue on this trajectory, if they don't course correct, they're going right back into exile. It's a one-way trip for them. And they're grieved. But what was interesting was 3 weeks ago, Nehemiah instructed them not to grieve. You've heard that God is not happy with this kind of behavior. You're cut to the quick. Your conscience is bearing witness against you. You want to repent from it. Nehemiah is saying, stop grieving about this. You need to go out and eat the fat. You need to go out and drink. You need to go out and share your portions with others and celebrate. Why? Why was he concerned with the fact that they were grieving? Well, one reason is because notice that it affected their appetite. You might remember that fasting is the natural, inevitable response to a grievous moment. And you've probably all experienced it at some point in your life. Whether you had a relationship go south, or whether your job or your career was put in jeopardy, or maybe one of your children, something happened and you were worried, maybe they were need to be in the hospital or whatever, and your response internally, physically, a loss of appetite. You're grieved and you can't even think of eating at such a time. You're so concerned with this terrible, grievous moment in your life that you can't do these normal, common things. You're grieving. Nehemiah says, look, you can't do that at this time because the festivals, we're entering a period where we're supposed to be celebrating the great and glorious God who regathers His people, who cleanses them, and then who brings all the families of the earth together to celebrate His mighty works in history. So that's the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacles. The regathering, the cleansing, and then this celebration. Tabernacles recall the period of time when they were leaving the Exodus and they had to trust in the Lord. But it foresees a time in the future where the families of the earth will come together and have to trust in the Lord for rain, for provision, for life. So he's saying this is not the time to grieve, because if you're walking around looking like Eeyore, sulking, not eating, not doing anything, you're going to completely kill this festival. You're not going to want to drink. You're not going to want to be merry. And we're not going to be magnifying God's name. So go out. Share. Celebrate. God is a compassionate God. And they must have been really bothered because they did this. But 3 weeks later, after the party's over, you know, this is the Tuesday. Sunday's ended. Tuesday. Christmas has ended. It's the 27th. It's not the 25th anymore. We've already opened the presents. We've already had family dinner. The relatives have finally gone home. It's back to business as usual, but they're not doing that. They're bothered. So they return together and they are grieved and they are fasting. It affected their appetite. It affected their appearance. They're not wearing their Sunday best. They're wearing an itchy, rough chafe machine made out of goat hair. And if that looks too good, they're making sure to throw dirt on themselves so they're not fashionable either. Okay, they're showing up. They're mourning internally, physically, spiritually, and they're making sure everybody around them knows it. But thirdly, it affected their associations. And as unpopular as it sounds today, the Israelites are saying, look, if you're not an Israelite, if you did not descend from our father, you're not welcome here anymore. You're not part of this assembly. You don't have a portion in our returning to the Lord. Now, you want to put on an itchy dirt sack and go and starve yourself, be our guest, but you can't do it here. You don't got to go home, but you don't got to be here. Can't be here. So go find some new friends. And I look at all these activities and I ask, what was the purpose for their assembling in the most uncomfortable, unattractive, and unpopular way possible? Well, I mean, why put yourself through it? Why are they going through it? Verse 2 says that they came and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. So they're coming with a purpose. All right? This isn't business as usual. It's not, okay, well, it's Sunday, so we go, we listen to Caleb stand up and go on for a little while, have a little cracker and have some juice, and then we go about our business. They came on a mission. They've prepared themselves beforehand, and there's no question as to why they're there. They're coming together having discovered the frequency and the depth of their departure from God's law, so they come together for the purpose of seeking forgiveness, for the purpose of seeking restoration. And the way they're going to seek it is through repentance and covenant renewal. If you want God's forgiveness, if you want this relationship restored, they're saying, we know first we got to own what we've done. You can't call evil good and then get along with God. Because if you're calling evil good, ultimately what you're doing is saying something that God has said is evil is wrong. You're saying, God, you're evil at the end of things. See, it's not right to call, let's say, homosexuality. Throw that out there. God says homosexuality is a sin. If I take a different position, I'm saying, well, guess what, God? I disagree. In fact, your position is evil. There's only two sides. They're saying we have to agree with our God. We have to ask forgiveness where we've erred. We're seeking it. And then we're looking for this renewal of relationship, this restoration. We want to start over. And it's not just based on their feeling or what they think God is like. Because the fact is, look, God's not like you or me. He's not. He is a transcendent God. So which means, like, we look around in the earth, you see a rock, a tree, a plant. I can scientifically observe these things and learn things about them, their makeup, kind of get a guess what certain chemical reactions will be with things. But I'm dealing with things in the world. God is outside the world. I can't measure God. He's everywhere. Not in the world, even beyond it. I can't make God do anything. I've got nothing to hold against Him, nothing to ransom. He's not anything like me. And the only way that this God who exists outside of our world, the only way I can know anything about Him is if He stoops down, if He condescends in love or compassion to say, let me tell you what I'm like. It's not what I imagine Him to be like. I may want a God that acts a particular way. I'm just looking at a mirror in the sky. That's not going to help me. He has to tell me, and I have to listen to His word. So that's what they do, is they come together, and for a fourth of a day, that's 3 hours, they're spending time in the Word. They got to know what He's like. It's not just where they feel like they maybe have gone wrong. It's where He's told them. They listen to the Word. They find out what He's like. And then in response, they are repenting. In response, they are confessing. In response, they are worshiping. Now, their situation is laid out in a prayer that's going to follow for the remainder of chapter 9. It's going to be led by the Levites. Verse 5, they're going to tell the congregation, look, arise, bless the Lord your God forever and ever. And as we find it, the prayer itself is going to begin in verse 6, potentially with Ezra leading. The Septuagint's going to say that. And what follows is going to be what we have as the longest prayer in the Old Testament. It's one of those ones that goes on and on. You're saying, all right, where is it headed? It's a rehearsal of the biblical story. It's an exposition of the character God. It is the reasoning of their therefore. Because of this, therefore, this is why we do what we do. It's because of who you are that we're coming to you this way. And obviously there's a lot of content that we could talk about explicitly describing this God who is forbearing, this God who is forgiving, this God who is long-suffering, this character who has revealed himself in history and in our story. And we're going to take time, as I mentioned, in 2 weeks to talk about that. But for today, I just want you to notice this. Just look at the verbs. I just want to notice what we can pull from the verbs in this. I'm just going to read you some of the verbs from verse 6 to verse 29. Tell me what you can gather from God from this. Listen to this. Verse 6. You made. You give. You chose. Brought. Gave. You found. You fulfilled. Verse 9. You saw and heard. You performed. You knew. You divided. You hurled. You led. You came down and spoke. You gave. You made known and laid down. Verse 15. You provided. You brought forth. You told. You swore. Verse 16. But they acted and listened not. Verse 17. They refused and remembered not. They became and appointed. But you are, and you forsook not. Verse 18. Even when they made and said and blasphemed, verse 19, you did not forsake. You gave. You did not withhold, and you gave. You provided. You also gave and allotted. They took. You made and you brought. Verse 24, their sons entered. You subdued and you gave. They captured, they took, they ate, were filled, grew fat and reveled. They became and rebelled and cast and killed. They blasphemed greatly. You delivered. They cried, you heard, you gave. They did evil. You abandoned. They cried again, you heard, you rescued. You admonished. They acted and did not listen and turned and stiffened and listened not. Verse 30, you bore with and admonished. They would not. You gave. You forsook not. Verse 31, you are. I find it very interesting that even without all the nouns, even with all these little prepositions, without all the little connecting words that give us the details, we can still get a picture of God's character. This is not propositional like God is omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, etc. This is not a list of these doctrines you must believe. God is a personal God of action. And we learn who He is and what He's like as He comes into history, this transcendent God, entering into our world, this fleshly, touchy-feely world, and He acts. He is a God of action. And I look at His actions and I can know just what He's like based on how He acts. The verbs. Very interesting. Now when I look at this, the verb that sticks out the most to me, at least in this prayer, probably because it's the most that appears in my translation, it appears about 8 times or so, is the verb that is translated, what? Did you pick it out? To give. To give. God gives and He gives and He gives. And I look at this and I ask myself, how often do my complaints against God come from the perspective that He's a taker? Lord, why'd you take this? You take, you take, you take. My career, my wealth, my possessions, my relationships, my happiness, my health, my future. You take. And I think of that, and then I ask, looking at this, is that even possible? Is it possible for God to be primarily described as a taker? Is it possible? Well, there's a problem here. God has to be the giver. You know, if He wasn't there, there wouldn't really be anything to take. If He's not given, there's nothing He has to take. He's a giver, first and foremost. Primarily, our God gives. He loves to give. And we're needy people. I think of Job, who said it well. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. But might have been an even better statement if he just said, "The Lord gives." Full stop. The Lord gives. He is a giving God, a God of provision. The next verb I find in here sticking out in this text appears at least four times. Three times it's mentioned that God did not forsake. He did not forsake. Once it is mentioned that God abandoned, same word, God forsook. And what's interesting to me in looking at the biblical story as presented in Ezra's prayer is that this doesn't appear in reference to God's trustworthiness. When I found that term, I think of Solomon, for example. David's prayer for Solomon, he says, "Look, if you forsake God, you know, if you stray, if you're going in a different direction, if you abandon Him, if you abandon His truth, then He'll forsake you. You need to seek God." There's a question of whether Solomon would stay true to the Word, stay true to his promise, stay true to his covenant. That's not the question being asked of God here. It's not as though God might turn back from the covenant and promises that He's made. Instead, notice how it appears in every instance. In fact, it is accompanied in every instance by another word. Look at verse 17. "They refused to listen and did not remember your wondrous deeds which you had performed among them. They became stubborn and appointed a leader to return to their slavery in Egypt. But you are a God of forgiveness, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness. You did not forsake them." So in response to their rebellion, their treachery against covenant, their treachery against following your ways, they forsook you. Your response, well, you did not forsake. Instead, you showed compassion. Verse 19, "You, in your great compassion, did not forsake them in the wilderness." Verse 31, "Nevertheless, in your great compassion, you did not make an end of them or forsake them, for you are gracious and compassionate, God." Even in verse 28, where we find "he forsakes," notice it. "As soon as they had rest, they did evil again before you." This is talking about the cycles like in Judges and Kings where the people rebel constantly against God even after He delivers them. It says, "As soon as they had rest, they did evil again. Therefore you abandoned," the term is forsook, "you abandoned them to the hand of their enemies so that they ruled over them. But look, when they cried again to you, you heard from heaven, and many times you rescued them according to your compassion." Even whenever it gets down to the end of it, they're so rebellious He has to deliver them. Even in that instance, He cannot fully forsake. Why? Not only is He a giving God, He is a compassionate God. He is a compassionate God that knows us in our need, wants to meet us in our need, and desires to restore us. He's a giver. He's compassionate. I think of that old hymn, "How Firm a Foundation." "The soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not desert to his foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no never, no never forsake." He's a faithful God, a compassionate God, a giving God. And in conclusion then, based on this, based on looking at this story, the people gathering together and learning who their God is and recognizing their position before Him, verse 38, "Now because of all this, we are making an agreement in writing. And on the sealed document are the names of our leaders, our Levites, and our priests." We're making a commitment and we're putting our names on it. Why? Well, because they mean it. I mean, they're saying it. They fully intend to carry it out. Why sign your name to it? If you go to a bank and you want to get a loan for a car, what are they going to make you do? Well, you better put your name on it. Now, this isn't something that you get to change your mind tomorrow if you mean it. If you want to enter into agreement, if you mean it, put your name on it. I think of church membership. What would be our response? We think in the secular world, I think of things like loans. What would be your response? Church membership is a covenant, if you actually had to put your name on a covenant. Would that be a problem? if you mean it. Here the people mean it. They come, they say, covenant renewal, the Mosaic covenant, we mean it. We're going to put our name on it. And the leaders come first. Verse chapter 10, you're going to have a list of them. But notice verse 28 and 29. This isn't just the heads who are accountable. Verse 28 of chapter 10. Now the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, etc., all the way down to all those who had knowledge and understanding, verse 29, joining with their kinsmen and nobles, are taking on themselves a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given through Moses, God's servant, and to keep and to observe all the commandments of God, our Lord, and His ordinances and His statutes. So they come together. After they've seen the Lord miraculously regather this people, miraculously build up the walls and protect the city 52 days, held off their enemies, now they're looking for covenant renewal to actually be God's people. We're going to do it right this time. Messiah is coming. We're going to be ready. We're going to see that kingdom. And they swear on three specific areas. They say, we're following this whole covenant, but notice this. Verse 30. We will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land or take their daughters for our sons. They're going to submit to God's domestic decrees. They're not going to mix together light and darkness. Why? Now, this was a problem. If you recall, this was the catalyst for the division of the kingdom. Solomon had a problem with this. 1 Kings 11. Why was his heart turned away from God? He married unbelievers. He yoked together with people who had no regard for God. And to appease them, his heart was turned away. He went after false gods. They said, we're not going to do it. We specifically will not make that mistake again. We can get it right. We can succeed where they fail. Verse 31. And as for the peoples of the land who bring wares or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we're not going to buy from them. Not on the Sabbath or a holy day. And we will forego the crops on the seventh year. And the exaction of every debt. Not only that, God, we also recall that part of the reason that we had a 70-year time out was because we weren't giving you your Sabbaths, God. So you put us in time out so that not only are our neglect of your Sabbath day, the seventh year where the land was supposed to stay fallow, we weren't supposed to work it, we weren't supposed to be greedy, we were supposed to give thanks for this provision you've made and trust in you, and we didn't. We're going to do that now. We can get that right. And the seventh year, you know, when we're supposed to give all people their stuff back to care for the poor, to care for those who are hurting, who've lost their land, who've sold themselves into slavery. We're going to make that right too. We will do the social justice. We will take care of the land. We will trust you. And we will honor your days, God, because we can do it. Because we can do it. So I see that they've committed to the domestic decrees and the commercial decrees. Notice it. Verse 32. We also place ourselves under obligation to contribute yearly 1/3 of a shekel to the service on the house of our God. And then for the remainder of this chapter, we see they're committed to contribute to the work of the Lord. We're not going to let that temple go into disrepair, God. We know that that's where our lifeline is. We have to have a temple and we have to have a working priesthood to teach us the law. We're going to do it right, Lord. We're going to put you first. We're going to do it right this time. It's a new generation in the land, and we're going to do it right. I don't know when y'all came to faith in your life. Some of you may have had the good fortune of growing up in a family of believers and not being able to even remember a time before you knew the Lord. I grew up in a family of believers. My grandfather was a preacher, so I knew enough about the Word to get me in trouble. Like, I was in church as long as my family was in church until I was old enough to not have to go to church. And I knew enough about the Bible. I knew enough verses. I had good information to argue, kind of like that Pharisee that was talking with Jesus. You know, who is my neighbor? He knows the verses. He knows the greatest verse. Love the Lord God with all your heart, mind, soul. Love your neighbor as yourself. Yeah, that's right, Jesus. But who's my neighbor? I knew enough to argue. But I distinctly remember the moment when the Lord came into my life and changed it. And suddenly I realized, wait a minute. You're God. This is my position before you. This is your word where I can go to learn about you. And I start digging in and reading. And for the first time in my life, this thing made sense. And you know what I thought? I can do it. I'm going to do it. This isn't too hard, just like Moses says. Not that I'm following the law. I'm in the New Testament. I wasn't sitting there chewing up Deuteronomy or Leviticus. I wasn't out there trying to find me a goat or grow out my sideburns or anything like that. But I'm reading even the New Testament. I'm looking, I'm saying, Lord, this is so easy. Loving my neighbor, I can do this. And I tried. But surprise, it wasn't very long. Here's my clean slate. I'm a believer. We're going to start. What did I find myself doing? Oh, I found out some of that same old person still walking around with me. Okay. I have a new relationship and I have a new character, but I still have that old character, and that's going to be a problem. In my arrogance, I thought, yeah, I can do this. I can pull myself up by my bootstraps. I found out it's a little bit more complicated than that. And Israel finds out as well. This is very interesting. The city is repopulated. The city is rededicated in the 11th chapter, the 12th chapter. And guess what? Where does Nehemiah go? The governor, the guy who came from Persia. He had a job to do, right? Well, he wanted to rebuild the walls, but he really wanted to remove the reproach from the people. He wanted to restore the people to their God. Mission accomplished. He's come. He saw. He conquered. He built those walls. He removed the enemies. The people became zealous. Look, they were on fire. They just did covenant renewal. They just took on a curse if they don't follow the law. They said, all those things that got us in trouble, we're not going to do it again. And we're ready. He says, this is great. Now I can go back. And he does. For a time. But then we find things don't quite end happily ever after. The end of the Old Testament comes with an epilogue. Nehemiah, sometimes later, turn to chapter 13, he gets permission to come back. He's going to go back to the land, go back to his old stomping grounds and see how things are going. I set them on course. I put them on a trajectory. They had a clean slate. They're going to succeed where their fathers failed. How are they doing? Notice it. Chapter 13, verse 7. He comes back and he finds out things just aren't quite how he remembered them when he left. You know that feeling when you've been to a town, maybe you grew up in your hometown, you leave for a few years, you come back, that things aren't quite how you remember it, the grocery store is not where it used to be, the people aren't like they used to be, a golf course or something moved in, and now there's a different crowd. Here's Nehemiah, chapter 13, verse 7. He says, I came to Jerusalem, and I'm learning about the evil that the high priest Eliashib had done for Tobiah. You might remember that was one of those three stooges that have been giving Israel problems from the beginning in trying to build their walls and reconstitute a people. He says, the high priest is in cahoots with Tobiah. He has prepared a room for him in the courts of the temple. It was very displeasing to me, so I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. And I gave an order, and they cleansed the rooms. And I returned there the utensils of the house of God, with the grain, offerings, and the frankincense. I also discovered, though, that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them. They're not being given their food. The people said they were going to provide for the Lord's service, for His work at the temple. But now the Levites and the singers who performed the service, they had to go away to His own field. They can't even be bivocational. Okay, they can't feed themselves. They have to spend all day gleaning so that they can survive. So I reprimanded the officials and said, why is the house of God forsaken? It's only been a couple years. Maybe few, but not many. Then I gathered them together and restored them to their posts. Within just a matter of years, they have completely neglected their religious obligations. They've neglected the temple. They've neglected the people who are able to give them understanding of the law. Can't pay them. We can get by without them. But that's not all. Notice it. Verse 15. In those days I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys as well as wine, grapes, figs, all kinds of loaves. They brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. So I admonished them on the day they sold food. Also, men of Tyre were living there who imported fish and all kinds of merchandise, and they sold them to the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. Then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, What's this evil thing you're doing by profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do the same, so that our God brought on us and on this city all this trouble? Yet you're adding to the wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. They've neglected their religious duties. They've neglected their decrees, the commercial decrees, the promises to provide for those who cannot provide for themselves, the promise to observe God's holy days. But notice it. Verse 23, that's not all. In those days, I also saw the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. As for their children, half spoke in the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people. So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. Did not Solomon, the king of Israel, sin regarding these things? Yet among the many nations there wasn't a king like him, and he was loved by his God. God made him king over all of Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused even him to sin. Do we not even hear about you that you committed all this great evil by acting unfaithfully against our God by marrying foreign women? They've neglected their religious duties, their commercial duties, even their duties in society, their domestic obligations. And they're heading back on that trajectory again. And once again, we have the lone man coming back trying to call a rebellious nation to repentance. Nehemiah, verse 30. Thus I purified them from everything foreign and appointed duties for the priests and the Levites, each in his task. And I arranged for the supply of wood at appointed times and for the first fruits. Remember me, O my God, for good. The curtain goes down. Nehemiah says, look, I did everything I could. I removed all the hedges. I took away all the weeds out of the Israelites, all the stumbling blocks, but even though they're starting with a clean slate, the problem is they're still the same people. And they still have the same heart. And I wonder, what will change? But I remember, the clock's ticking. The clock's ticking, and as we move towards the fulfillment of these feasts they've been celebrating, the one who's going to come and ultimately regather this exiled nation, the one who will come and purify the people, the one who will come as king and will rule the world, he's on his way. The clock's ticking. And I look at this people as they're trying to pull themselves up and do what only this one can do. I think of myself. I think of my efforts. I think of the words of David Klingler, who says, look, if we could do what only he could do, we wouldn't need him to do what only he could do. I said, the problem is a heart. I got a bad heart. I need a new heart. How am I going to get a new heart? Listen to it. Jeremiah 32. When the king comes, Jeremiah 32. This is Jeremiah 32, verse 37. He says, I'm going to gather all my people out of the lands which I've driven them in my anger, in my wrath, in great indignation. I'll bring them back to this place, make them dwell safely. They shall be my people, I will be their God, and I will give them one heart and one way that they may fear me always for their own good and for the good of their children after them. And I will make an everlasting covenant with them that I will not turn away from them to do them good, and I will put the fear of me in their hearts, so that they will not turn away from me. I will give. The God who gives, the God of compassion, the God who will not forsake his rebellious people, he's going to do it. How's it going to happen? He's going to do it all. From start to finish. Not with our help. He's going to come and do it. Zechariah, when I think of the Day of Atonement, I certainly think of that prophet speaking during the time of Nehemiah. I think of his words in Zechariah chapter 13. He says this, in that day, this day when the king comes, a fountain will be opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for impurity. He's going to bring the water of cleansing. He's going to wash away their sins. He's going to give them a new heart. I think of Zechariah 14. And the Lord will be king over all the earth in that day. The Lord will be the only one, His name the only one. Verse 16. And then it will come about. Then any who are left of all the nations that went against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Trust, the feast where you're looking to God's provision. It will be that whichever of the families of the earth doesn't go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, there'll be no rain. The King's coming, and He's going to do it. He's going to provide a new way. He's going to provide a new heart. He's going to make a new people. He's going to put them in their land. He's going to rule them in righteousness. And the clock's ticking.